My guest today, the food critic and memoirist Ruth Reichel, received some less than flattering reviews about her new novel, Delicious.
Not entirely complimentary is an understatement. It was the nastiest review I have ever read of any book anywhere.
How do you deal with that?
I have to tell you that this one, it was really tough. Because this is a critic I really admire. So if it's someone you don't like, you know, who you think is an idiot, that's one thing. But if it's someone whose opinions you respect, it's really difficult.
On today's Between the Lines, she discusses how she deals with such reviews, what the difference is between writing fiction and memoir, and so much more. Please stay tuned. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper.
Tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way, cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, and loving you later as if at all.
And welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. My guest today is one of the most acclaimed food writers of our time. It's Columbia County's Ruth Reichel, whose impressive resume includes being a restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times and New York Times, the editor-in-chief for Gourmet magazine for 10 years. She's written several cookbooks, along with not just one, but four critically acclaimed best-selling memoirs, Tender at the Bone, Comfort Me with Apples, Garlic and Sapphires, and Not Becoming My Mother. She's also hosted several food shows on TV, and now she's penned her first novel, Delicious. I'll just give a quick synopsis. The novel follows the story of heroine Billy Breslin, who travels to New York from California, lands a job on the revered food magazine Delicious, and becomes known for her unique sense of taste, an ability to identify any ingredient in any dish. The plot goes into high gear when Delicious is unexpectedly closed and Billy starts unearthing a series of mysteries. One features the late James Beard and involves secret rooms and a hidden cache of letters written by a young girl to Beard during World War II. So thanks so much for coming on Between the Lines, Ruth.
A pleasure.
And you're going to read us an excerpt from the book.
So this is where Billy is being introduced to what is known as the Delicious Guarantee, which is something I always wished we did at Gourmet, which is money back if the recipe doesn't work. And she says, well, wait a minute, you must give an awful lot of money back. And Jake, her editor, says to her, no, actually, we almost never have to give anyone their money back, because the truth is most people can't follow recipes. And this is her second letter. I'm absolutely furious about the scallop mousse in the current issue, wrote a Mrs. Cloverly from Cleveland. It is simply vile. On the phone, her querulous voice conjured up white hair and a pasty body muffled in a voluminous apron. I have made a great many dishes in my life, she informed me, and this was, without any doubt, the vilest of the lot. I tried to sound sympathetic. I'm so sorry. Let me find that recipe. I punched it into the database, and up it came, along with ecstatic 4-star and 5-star reader comments. I would never have believed, one reader wrote, that scallops, cream, a couple of eggs, and a splash of wine could make anything so divine. Mrs. Cloverly had clearly gone off the rails. This is the first complaint we've had about that recipe. Most people are just too lazy to call. I pictured her shaking a finger at the phone. But that is a dreadful recipe, and I consider it my duty to warn other cooks away. A magazine that once employed James Beard has no business running such trash. And I'd like to point out that those ingredients were very costly. I expect you to honor the Delicious Guarantee and refund the money that I spent.
Let me see where the problem might lie, I began. Let's start with the scallops. What kind did you buy? The large sea scallops or the little bay kind? Oh, really? Her voice was chilly now. I would never purchase scallops. They are far too expensive. I substituted canned clams. Any other substitutions? I inquired. Perhaps you used half and half in place of heavy cream. Don't be ridiculous. Now she was cross. I never have cream in the house. It is far too rich. I always use powdered milk. Of course. I could almost see her kitchen as she talked. It would be small, maybe a double-wide trailer with one of those half-refrigerators and a tiny stove. She sounded so sad. I don't imagine you had any wine on hand. I used water, but I did add a bit of lemon juice just to give it some zip. Trying to imagine how this bizarre amalgamation might have tasted, I suffered a complete failure of the imagination. It was vile, she told me. Simply vile. Will you stand behind your guarantee? What was I supposed to do? May I put you on hold, I asked, for a moment? You must be new. Her voice had grown suspicious. That other girl never put me on hold. Never? Just how often had Mrs. Cloverly called? It will only be a moment, I said. Never mind. Her voice filled with weary resignation. I know what you're going to say. A bitter note crept in. One more institution that lies to the public and refuses to honor its promises. She sounded so lonely, so filled with despair. Send us your receipts, Mrs. Cloverly, I blurted out. We want everyone to be satisfied with the recipes and delicious. Really? She sounded shocked. Are you sure? Yes, ma'am. But as the words came out of my mouth, I suddenly saw the truth. Mrs. Cloverly was one of Jake's decoys. I had fallen into another trap. Why, thank you very much, dear. She sounded so triumphant that for a moment I almost believed she was for real. It's good to know there are still people who believe in honoring their promises. You have yourself a blessed day.
Thank you. That was great. Mrs. Cloverly is only one of many eccentric characters that populate this novel. Would you like to describe some of the others?
Well, my favorite eccentric character is Sammy, who's the travel editor of the magazine, and who speaks in the most archaic, convoluted language. It was very fun writing him. He started out modeled on a real person and then vanished into this wonderful, he's kind of the gay uncle every one of us wishes that we had. And he's a little bit like a fairy godfather. He's traveled everywhere, knows many people, has been in the business for a long time. And he takes Billy under his wing and tries to make her see herself as he sees her. Another wonderful eccentric is Sal, who is the proprietor of the little Italian cheese shop where Billy ends up working on the weekends. And he's kind of the cheese shop proprietor you wish you would encounter. And he really is modeled on a real person. He's modeled on Lou DiPaolo, who owns DiPaolo's in New York, in Little Italy. And I don't really know Lou very well, but he is endlessly generous and incredibly knowledgeable. And I've just sort of made him into, you know, another person who takes Billy under his wing and loves the fact that she has this fabulous palate.
Does he know that he's been used as a model for someone in this book?
Well, I was at DiPaolo's about a month ago, and his niece said to me, both her father and her uncle run the restaurant, and her aunt run this 100-year-old family cheese store. And the niece said to me, you know, you've sort of combined my father and my uncle perfectly and captured them. So I think he does have an inkling that he's the one.
Yeah. Well, it's very flattering, I would have thought, to be used as a model. And they do say write about what you know. And of course, this is the story of a magazine, a gourmet food magazine,
that closed suddenly. So how much of it was based on or taken from Gourmet?
Well, the magazine scenes, which are really just the opening, are very much taken from Gourmet. I mean, the test kitchen is very much our test kitchen. What I wanted to do was create a character who was, I mean, I've written 4 memoirs. I did not need to write another biography. So I wanted to take a character who was very much not me, put her in this world, and granted it's an idealized world, but this food world that I really love. I mean, I think food people are endlessly generous and giving. If a Billy had shown up at Gourmet, someone who was so troubled and so sort of closed down and hidden within herself, but also so passionate about food, I think we would have gathered around her in this way.
You've written 4 memoirs and now fiction. Why fiction? What propelled that path?
I love fiction more than anything. I mean, I for me, in my life, fiction has been the greatest gift. Other people drink, take drugs. When I'm in a really bad place, I vanish into a book. And I have known other people who do that as well. And I've always wanted to write a novel. When I first started writing about food, I became very close to M.F.K. Fisher, who was one of my great food heroines. I mean, she was, in the 30s and 40s, one of the few people who was writing intelligently about food and who understood why food is important. And I grew up reading her and interviewed her in the 70s for Ms. Magazine and became close to her. And in one of our early conversations, she looked at me and said, "Well, of course you want to write fiction." I said, "Of course I do." And she said, "Well, every writer wants to write fiction." And then she said, "But I tried and I couldn't do it."
I was going to say, did she ever try?
Well, she did, but she never really acknowledged the book. She was married to a publisher for a while, Donald Frieda, and she said, "Donald insisted that I write a novel." She said, "But it's not a novel and it's not good." And so I always thought, well, if Mary Frances can't do it, what makes me think I could do it? But then I sort of always put it off by saying, well, if I didn't have a day job, I would write fiction. And suddenly I didn't have a day job. And I had an editor who kept calling me and saying, "You should write a novel. You should write a novel."
You're quoted saying the best career moves are the ones that scare you.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's how you stay alive and how you keep learning is to do the things that you don't know how to do. I mean, it was like I'm starting to write the Gourmet memoir now, and it's very much about I knew nothing about how, I mean, had they known when they hired me how little I knew about how magazines are put together, they would have run screaming in the other direction. And I thought, I'm 50 years old and I'm being offered this opportunity to do something that I absolutely don't know how to do.
But you also can't not do it.
You can't not do it. And that's sort of how I felt. You know, I was felt, I mean, having the magazine close on my watch was a huge defeat. I mean, here was a magazine that existed for 69 years and closed on my watch. 60 people lost their jobs. It was a terrible time. So the one thing I thought, you know, how I am going to get myself, I'm going to challenge myself to do the hardest thing. And the hardest thing I can think of to do is to try and write a novel.
What inspired this particular novel?
Okay, this is kind of a long story, but bear with me. I was on book tour for the second Gourmet cookbook. And book tour is a very odd time because you end up having all this like little bits of time. And what I do in those off moments is I go to thrift stores and used bookstores and, you know, root around mostly for old cookbooks. And I found this cache of World War II ephemera, pamphlets from the Department of Agriculture, recipes for cooking with rations, how to plant a victory garden, ads for the Women's Land Army. And I got really interested in World War II. So while I was on tour, I was kind of researching World War II recipes and discovering that they were really, when we talk about vile recipes, they were mostly vile recipes. And while I was on tour, I got a call from my boss that I had to come back to New York, and he didn't tell me why. And I went back to learn that they were closing the magazine. It was a huge shock, and we were all just sort of stunned. And that night, we took all the wine that we had at the magazine, which was a lot of wine, to my house, and we had a wake for the magazine. And the next day, everybody else went back to pack up their offices, but I had to go back on tour for the Gourmet Cookbook, which was very odd.
It was not my book.
I mean, I didn't get a penny for it, but I was contractually obligated to tour for it. So I was gone for 5 weeks, and when I came back, I had to go into this now empty office and clean out my office. And the office itself was just a scene of incredible devastation. And people had been looting, and the broken furniture, and they'd locked the kitchen, and it was filled with rotten food. And I went into the one room that I knew would be unchanged, which was the library, because I had locked it. And it was just an office, really, that was filled with wonderful books. But I sat in there, and these books were kind of breathing around me. I noticed a cabinet that I had never noticed before, just a steel cabinet. And I went back, and it was filled with letters to the magazine, thousands and thousands and thousands of letters. And I started looking at them, and they were pretty boring. They were complaints about recipes and recipe submissions. And I went into my office, and I was just so demoralized about having to pack. And instead of starting to pack, I sat down and I wrote the letters I wished I had found in this file. And those were the Lulu letters.
The Lulu letters.
I just sat there all afternoon. And I don't know why I did it. It was something to keep myself from packing. But I had World War II in my head. And so this first letter is, you know, from Lulu to Dear Mr. Beard.
Isn't that interesting? It's true what they say, out of adversity comes opportunity.
Yes.
The Chinese say out of chaos comes opportunity. And you also, you wrote about this to a certain extent in the novel as well, when they're told Delicious is closing.
Yes, exactly. And I transferred it from a modern office building to a fabulous old mansion. And, you know, made this file cabinet into a whole secret room. But, I feel really lucky that I just put the letters away and kept them for a year. But when I went to write the book, and I finally said, okay, I'm going to write a novel, I knew I had these letters.
And James Beard figures prominently. And I know that you met him. And, of course, he died in, 1980 or
no, he
something?
Lives later than 80, I think. But because I remember his birthday party was in 1980.
Early 80s. Right. Now, did you have any caveats when you're using a real person in a fictional way?
Well, I mean, it was a very interesting exercise as a writer, because he never says a word in the book.
You only see
Lulu writes to Mr. Beard. He never writes to her. And so you only see him through her eyes. And as a writer, it was a fascinating challenge. You know, how can I would not presume to write James Beard's words. But, you know, how do you make someone who looms so large in the book be a real character without ever giving him a chance to say anything? And I started out very blithely, actually, and because I'd written these Lulu letters. And then I had to go back and really research his life and, you know, find out where he was at various points when she was writing to him. I mean, I learned a lot about him that I hadn't known, that he actually had signed up for the war. And then when he found out they weren't going to send him overseas, took an honorable discharge and actually had a very interesting time during the war, ended up setting up hotels and restaurants around the world for merchant seamen.
And we will just take a short break and we will be right back, so don't go anywhere.
It's up to you.
And you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and I'm here with Ruth Reichel, food critic extraordinaire. It sounds like, then, that it didn't take you that long to kind of conceive and actually execute this book.
Oh, it took me a long time. I actually had to learn how to write a novel, which is very, very different than writing nonfiction. And, I mean, it's so odd, you know, for someone who's read as voraciously as I have read, that I didn't know that as the author, I needed to know so much more than the reader needed to know. And I wrote one very literal book, which was basically me figuring out the backstory of every character. And then I pretty much threw it away. With that, with their voices now really firmly set in my head, was able to write the book. But I really had to. It was a shock when I realized that this thing that I thought was a novel was not a novel.
Yeah. This is one of the things they advise you to do, is to do detailed character studies of all of your characters so that you really do know them intimately. And also, writers tend to work on different ways. Some writers just get the plot down first, others the characters. Which came to you first?
For me, it's the characters, really. And once, you know, as I said, I wrote this novel which was figuring out the characters. And then once I knew who they were, I could let them be free. And so the plot changed enormously. I mean, I had a vague idea of where it was going and how Billy and Lulu would interact and where their lives would intersect. But as I was writing, because I at that point knew the characters so well, I was really able to give them the freedom to take me places that I didn't expect. And It was really fun. I mean, I would get up in the morning and think, I wonder what's going to happen to Billy today.
That's actually one of the things that you really get from the book. I think that really comes across, that you clearly enjoyed writing it. There is a real sense of fun throughout the whole thing, and a love of food, and a love for New York City, and a love for publishing in a way.
Well, you know, I grew up in publishing,
yeah.
I have a love for all of that, and I didn't intend this to be a love letter to New York, but it kind of turns out to be, you know, this complete love letter to New York City.
Yeah, and there's also so much in there about food. Now, do you think you have to be a bit of a foodie to appreciate this book?
I don't think so. I mean, I feel like, I think you have to like to, if you don't like food, you're going to find it boring, because there's a lot of everybody's eating and cooking all the time in it. But I think most people like food, and I don't think you have to be knowledgeable about food. I just think you have to take pleasure in the sensual aspects of food. Because for me, you know, food is, I mean, just the physical act of cooking is like a huge sensual pleasure to me.
One of the things I noticed is that I've only read one of your memoirs, but I do intend to read the others. I read Garlic and Sapphires. Now, I noticed it was a very different style of writing. Was that deliberate?
No, it was not. I mean, I mean, you write how you write, and it's odd, because I'm working on this next memoir, and I look back at my first, Tender at the Bone, and I realize that it's this one is very different than that one too. Mm. I mean, you grow up and you grow older, and what you do changes. And I don't really know how to write differently. I like simple writing. I mean, I as a reader, I find show-off writing annoying. And so I have a tendency, you know, if I look at something and think, is this overwritten? Mm-hmm. Just even asking myself that question means it goes. You know, I mean, I don't see any reason to...
Very disciplined. Kill your darlings.
I think that's one reason why writing Sammy was so much fun, because he was like, you know, I never use a 10-cent word if a nickel word will do.
Right.
And, you know, Sammy wants only, you know, dollar words.
Dollar words, yes. So what was the biggest challenge in writing this book?
The biggest challenge for me was Billy is 21 years old. And trying to write a 21-year-old, I mean, my son is 25 now, so he was, you know, I started this 3 years ago. So just like trying to listen to his language, listen to his friends, and making sure that I wasn't, you know, writing a 21-year-old who sounded like a 60-year-old. You know, it's not easy to write a younger generation and to think about things in that way, because life has changed so much.
What did Nick think of it, by the way?
Oh, Nick, I mean, I was so nervous about showing it to him, and he actually didn't read it till after it was published. And he said the sweetest thing. It just, it really, really sent chills down my back, you know, because I said, you know, I keep saying, you know, Billy is not me, Billy is not me. And he said, come on, Mom. You're the only person on earth who's as optimistic as she is.
Well, that's great. That's very flattering. What did you learn from this experience?
I learned that writing fiction is really fun. I mean, I learned that I really wanted to write more fiction, that there's a kind of freedom in being able to invent, and that in some ways it's easier to invent than it is to hew to the truth.
I read somewhere you're under contract to write two more.
I am. The minute I turned this in, they said, we want your next two novels.
Is it going to be Billy again?
No,
or because she's young, you know, she has a whole life of adventures ahead of her.
Because I was running out of the house, this is the Australian edition I was reading from, and my Australian publisher is pushing me hard to write a sequel to this.
Oh, okay.
But I am not, at least not this first novel, is totally different. Totally, totally different. I mean, I want to deal with very different issues.
Reviews. You've had some terrific reviews, and you've had some not so terrific reviews. And the New York Times, as you know, was not not entirely complimentary.
Not entirely complimentary is an understatement. It was the nastiest review I have ever read of any book anywhere.
How do you deal with that?
I have to tell you that this one, it was really tough, because this is a critic I really admire. So if it's someone you don't like, you know, who you think is an idiot, that's one thing. But if it's someone whose opinions you respect, it's really difficult. And, you know, my son was really helpful on this. Mm. And, you know, he said to me, come on, Mom, just own it. He said, you know, you disappointed him because he wanted you to write a heavier book. He thought you're a serious person and you do lectures about serious issues, and he's asking where's the politics in this book. And he said, just own the fact that you love escapist novels and that's what you wanted to write, and it's too bad if he didn't like it, but you did what you wanted to do. And I thought, he's absolutely right.
Fair enough.
I did what I wanted to do. And then I also thought, look, I wrote many, many really mean reviews
right?
in my, you know, I was a restaurant critic for 20 years, more than 20 years. And, you know, if you dish it out, you better be able to take it.
Will that kind of a review change how you write your next novel?
You know, for the first week, I mean, I would wake up in the middle of the night and just, like, be so humiliated by this review. And then the New York Times ran a Sunday review that was glowing, glowing, glowing. It was like the opposite. And it was like a moment for me of going, wait a minute, you know, you're just listening to the loudest voice here. And now that the New York Times has run a nice review, you think it's okay. And just get over the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a few people's opinions. Yeah. And people will like it and they won't like it. And that's their problem, not yours.
And what is it that some actors say? They don't read the good reviews and they don't read the bad reviews. So there might be something in that.
You have to set yourself a goal. And if you're satisfied that you've met that goal, then you're fine.
Yeah. I also read that, or I saw online, you have a little book club kit that if book clubs are going to read this book, you have a bunch of recipes and you have a bunch of suggested questions too, which I thought was kind of fun.
Well, that, you know, that's now par for the course. Every author does this. Okay. I mean, book clubs are such an important part of the reading public now that it's one of the things that your publishers ask you to do is, will you write a bunch of questions that people should answer? And in this case, they were, you know, would you throw in some recipes and suggest how to give an easy dinner party around your book? So, you know, the machine gears up and it gets you to do things you wouldn't have imagined you would be doing.
Right. And we will take a break and we'll be right back.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm out at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my top, sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. I be spiked out, I could trip a referee, tell by my attitude that I most definitely from with OG at a Yankee game. That made the Yankee hat more famous than a Yankee king. You should know I bleed blue, but I ain't a crypto. But I got a gang of walking with my click though. Welcome to the melting pot. Corners where we selling Africa been by the home of the hip-hop. Yellow cap, gypsy cap, dollar cap, holla back. For foreigners, it ain't fair, they act like they forgot how to act. 8 million stories out there in the naked city. It's a pity half of y'all won't make it. Me, I got a plug special ed, I got it made. If Jesus paying LeBron, I'm paying Dwayne Wade. Three dice CeeLo, three card Marley. Labor Day parade, rest in peace Bob Marley. Statue of Liberty, long live the World Trade, long live the King, yo. I'm from the Empire State. That's blinding. Girls need blinders or they could step out of bounds quick. The sidelines is lined with casualties who sip the life casually then gradually become worse. Don't fight the apple Eve. Caught up in the in crowd. Now you're in style and in the winter gets cold. In vogue with your skin out. City of sin. It's a pity on a whim. Good girls going bad. The city's filled with them. Mommy took a bus trip. Now she got a bust out. Everybody ride her just like a bus route. Hail Mary to the city. You're a virgin. And Jesus can't save you. Life starts when the church in. Came here for school, graduated to the highlight. Ball players, rap stars, addicted to the limelight. MDMA got you feeling like a champion. The city never sleeps, better slip you an ambient.
Welcome back to Between the Lines. If you just joined us, I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. I'm here with the food critic and writer Ruth Reichel. You said you're a big fiction reader, so what books are on your bedstand?
At the moment, I'm reading Julia Glass's fabulous new novel, The Dark Sacred Night, which is just wonderful. I just finished Michelle Hunnivan's last novel. She's another writer I really love. I'm also deeply immersed in the Dorothy Dunnett series. I love historical fiction. I just discovered Dorothy Dunnett, and I've just read through the Niccolo series, and I'm starting on the Lyman series.
Do you read according to how it fits into what you're writing? Do you read to help your writing?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Okay.
And I both always have a physical book going, and I listen to hundreds of books on tape. I mean, I listen while I'm driving, while I'm walking on the subway, while I'm cooking. So I consume a few books a week in my ears.
What about a Kindle?
I am the daughter of a book designer. I read physical books. I love think, the idea of Kindle.
Yeah.
But.
You know, I was reluctant to get one, and then I got one, and I found that it's not instead of, it's as well as. There are some places where Kindle is just great, and I actually found I read more, because it's really easy to get books instantly on a Kindle.
Right.
And to satisfy whatever your immediate desire was. So,
well, you can do that with Audible, too.
Right.
You see a book you want it, you download it, and you have it in 10 minutes.
You're a longtime resident of Columbia County.
I am.
Has that influenced your A, writing, and B, cooking at all?
Both. Enormously. Cooking is the easier answer, just because, you know, we're surrounded by farmers, and I think it's very hard if you're in the city to eat locally, sustainably. Up here, you don't really have an excuse not to if you can afford to. But I buy my eggs from somebody who has, you know, down the road, who has a little egg stand, and I buy my food at farmers markets and local fruit stands, and I buy all the meat I buy is from within 50 miles of my house. And it has really changed the way I cook. The writing part is, I think, I live quite near Steepletop, and I built myself a little studio, kind of like Emily Dickinson's, a little cabin in the woods that's heated only with wood. And it's really hard for me to write if I'm not out there. I mean, it's just so perfect. It's quiet. It's, you know, I just sit there and deers go crashing past, and it's not wired for the internet, and you know, there's nothing more wonderful than just sitting out there all day and
in a room of your own.
Exactly.
As Virginia Woolf said, it's all we need to write, a room of our own. We discussed this a bit before, but you haven't actually been to our studio before, but I should say that you were involved with WGXC right at the beginning. You held a fundraiser in your home, right? So thank you for that. We're still around, thanks to you, Ruth.
And which Swoon, very, very, they donated all the food and did a fabulous catering job for that. Really fabulous. So kudos to them, too.
What chefs do you admire?
The person I admire most right now is Dan Barber, who is actually he was raised partly in Great Barrington on his grandmother's farm. But his new book, The Third Plate, Notes on the Future of Food, is the most interesting piece of food writing that's come out in years. And he has Stone Barns, Blue Hill at Stone Barns down in Westchester, which I think is the most interesting restaurant in the country, and certainly one of the most interesting restaurants in the world, where they are really not just talking the talk, but walking the walk. I mean, they raise everything, they recycle, they use everything, you know, down to like turning the bones into charcoal. The food is fascinating. It's a different kind of restaurant experience. Zach Palacio here in Hudson is also another person. I mean, lots of chefs talk about being local and sustainable. Nobody is doing it the way Zach and Jory are doing it here, where they really are buying whole animals. They're canning in the summer to serve food in the winter, making their own fish sauce for mm-hmm. Southeast Asian food from local shad. I mean, they are really committed to the idea of doing local food, and it's another, it's very hard to do. I think people don't realize how easy it is to just go out and buy your ingredients mm-hmm. and how difficult it is to really, I mean, when you buy a whole pig, to use every bit of that pig and to persuade your customers to eat that, it's mm-hmm. not easy. And Alice Waters, who's like one of my oldest and closest friends, is another chef I really admire.
And you ran a restaurant once, right? Swallow?
The Swallow. Yeah. And we were, you know, this was a real countercultural restaurant in the 70s. We were a collective. We all did everything. But it was, you know, one of those Berkeley restaurants that was the beginning of the discovery of food.
Would you ever think about doing that again?
Oh, God, no.
Okay. I mean, I was just thinking, gosh, you're waxing euphoric about the food and everything, and what could be more perfect than opening a restaurant? No,
well,
never mind.
A restaurant critic who opens a restaurant is just asking for it.
Okay. Did you ever read Elizabeth David, by the way?
In fact, I wrote the introduction to the last American cookbook of hers.
I loved her an omelette and a glass of wine. And I remember reading the book, and then I would cook every boyfriend that came along an omelette and a glass of wine. They'd sort of look at it, you know, and I would think it was just fantastic because I was imbued with Elizabeth Davidness. But
Well, what fascinates me about Elizabeth David is she's so unlike most of the American cookery writers, who all tend to be sort of very good girls.
Yeah.
She was a wild woman. Why somebody doesn't make a movie of her life? I mean,
yeah. I think she's probably gone out of fashion a bit. She maybe needs to be rediscovered.
But, you know, she really, I mean, for the English, she was...
She was revolutionary.
Julia Child, MFK
That's
Fisher,
right. Rolled into
James
one.
Beard, she and came, Chuck Williams.
She came back after the war, and she started using Mediterranean recipes, and she introduced olive oil, and she went down to the grocery store and tried to persuade them to get peppers in or something that was, you know, more exotic than the usual fare that they had.
And she was dreaming of, you know, she'd been in Egypt, and she was sitting in dreary, cold England dreaming about lemons and oranges.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Very vivid passages in her books about that.
And I actually had dinner with her once.
Oh, you did?
She was a very difficult woman.
I heard that too, yeah, in later years, yeah. One last question. I was looking at a website today called The New Potato.
Ah.
And Zach Posen named you as one of the five people that he, living or dead, that he would want to have at his mythical dinner party. Really? If he could have anybody, living or dead. So who would be it doesn't have to be five, it could be six people, it could be seven. Who would be your dinner guests, living or dead, if you could have the dinner party of your dreams?
Well, you know, you sort of have to go for dead people, because the living people are possible. I mean, the first person I would choose is the first Queen Elizabeth, who just fascinates me. And Cleopatra does, too. I mean, these are like probably the two most powerful women in history, and I would love to be at a table with the two of them. This is, both of them are pre-Columbian exchange, so you would be able to introduce them to all these foods they had never eaten before.
Or you could also do a dish from their time.
You could do a dish from their time, but it would be much more interesting to give them, I mean, think what you could give them, chocolate, tomatoes, corn, sweet potatoes. you know, none of these things had ever come their way. And I just love to be at a table with the two of them. I mean, you'd want to have Shakespeare there because at least you'd finally figure out who he was.
And did he really write all those plays?
And did he write all those plays? So how could you not want to have him? There are a few of the ancient Greeks who, you know, you'd want to have there. I mean, Virgil. The possibilities are just... I mean, I'd like to have Thomas Jefferson at the table, too.
Okay, I think that's fine.
Okay.
You can have another one. Let's see, Thomas Jefferson, Virgil, Shakespeare, Queen Elizabeth I, Cleopatra. You can have one more.
Who else would I have? Now I'm thinking maybe, although he wouldn't be a good eater, but he would interest me is Muhammad.
The prophet?
The prophet.
Yeah, that would actually be an interesting conversation. So what do you think, Muhammad, of what's going on in your name today, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, what did you really want? Did you really want women wearing burqas? And, I mean, what do you think of all the violence that's been done in your name anyway?
Yeah, and who, you know, which of the prophets really, which are you going to choose? The Shia or the Sunni?
Could you sort out Iraq for us, please?
Wouldn't you want him there?
Sure, yeah. You would. Well, I hadn't. Yes, I. Now that you mention it, yes, would be because he would have very strict dietary requirements.
No,
you know,
he apparently would eat just about anything except for lizards, which he loathed.
Well, you probably wouldn't be serving lizards anyway. Or maybe you would. Have you ever eaten a lizard?
No, but I've eaten many other insects and reptiles, but not lizards.
Following in the footsteps of Anthony Bourdain. Okay, Ruth Reichel, it's been a pleasure having you on Between the Lines. Thank you so much for taking the time.
This was really fun. Thanks.
Welcome back to Between the Lines. Ruth Reichel mentioned M.F.K. Fisher, the famous American food writer, whose personal essays about cooking originally appeared in The New Yorker. And for those who don't know her work, I thought I might read an excerpt from one of her essays called Once a Tramp, Always. There is a mistaken idea, ancient but still with us, that an overdose of anything from fornication to hot chocolate will teach restraint by the very results of its abuse. A righteous and worried father, feeling broad-minded and full of manly understanding, will urge a rich cigar upon his fledgling and almost force him to be sick to show him how to smoke properly. Another, learning that his sons have been nipping Dago Red, will chain them psychologically to the dinner table and drink them under it, to teach them how to handle their liquor like gentlemen. Such methods are drastic and of dubious worth, I think. People continue to smoke and to drink and to be excessive or moderate according to their own needs. Their good manners are a matter more of innate taste than of outward training. Craving, the actual and continued need for something, is another matter. Sometimes it lasts for one's lifetime. There is no satisfying it, except temporarily, and that can spell death or ruin. At least three people I know very well, children of alcoholic parents, were literally born drunk. And after sad experience, they face the hideous fact that one more nip will destroy them. But they dream of it. Another of my friends dreams of chocolate and is haunted by sensory fantasies of the taste and smell of chocolate, and occasionally talks of chocolate the way some people talk of their mistresses, that one Hershey bar would damn him, and his liver too. (Parenthesis) Members of AA pray to God daily to keep them from taking that first drink. A first candy bar can be as dangerous. (Close parenthesis) These people choose to live, no matter how cautiously, because they know that they can never be satisfied. For them, real satiety, the inner spiritual kind, is impossible. They are, although in a noble way, cheating. An honest satyr will risk death from exhaustion, still happily aware that there will always be more women in the world than he can possibly accommodate. Somewhere between the extremes of putative training in self-control and unflagging discipline against wild cravings lie the sensual and voluptuous gastronomical favourites of a lifetime, the nostalgic yearnings for flavours once met in early days, the smell or taste of a gooseberry pie on a summer afternoon at Peachblow Farm, the whiff of anise from a Marseille bar. Old or moderately young of any sex, most of us can forgo the analyst couch at will and call up such flavours. It is better thus. Kept verbal, there is small danger of indigestion, and in truth, a gooseberry pie can be a horror, those pale beady acid fruits, the sugar never masking their mean acidity, the crust sogging. My father rhapsodised occasionally about the ones at Peachblow, and we tried to recapture their magic for him, but it was impossible. And a glass of pastis at the wrong time and with the wrong people can turn into a first-class emetic, no matter how it used to make the mind and body rejoice in Provence. Most people like to talk, once steered onto the right track, about their lifetime favourites in food. It does not matter if they only dreamed of them for the past countless decades. Favourites remain, and mankind is basically a faithful bunch of fellows. If you loved Fanny Bryce, from no matter how far away, you still can and do, and why not? There is, in this happily insatiable fantasizing, no saturation point, no moment at which the body must cry, "Help!" And that was an excerpt from M.F.K. Fisher's essay, Once a Tramp, Always a Tramp. This has been Between the Lines, and my guest today was Ruth Reichel, the food critic and memoirist turned novelist. And you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. We go out on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. on WGXC at 90.7 FM, Creative Community Radio. And the music you were listening to today was Sarah Bareilles, Between the Lines. Then we had UB40 with Red Red Wine, Jay-Z and Alicia Keys and Empire State of Mind. Then the Beatles with Savoy Truffle. To take us out, we have Peaches by Presidents of the United States. Thanks so much for listening. And I'll be back the same time next month.
Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Peaches come from a can, they were put there by a man in a factory downtown. And if I had my little way, I'd eat peaches every day, sun soaking bulges in the shade. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country.